Hello, it's Friday 19th of February. I'm Andrew Pearce and this is the Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, it's going to be spring soon, thank the Lord. We're going to give you some advice on how to spring clean your computer. Greek tourism. Could we be going on holiday to the Greek islands this summer? I think we could. We'll show you how. Harry and Meghan, the latest twist in the saga. The Queen has stripped them of their royal patronages. They say they're never coming back as working royals. Will they be missed? And the COVID vaccine rollout. The next category, age category, will be 40 to 49 year olds. Not teachers, not key workers, 40 to 49 year olds. Is that the right approach? So the Queen has moved to strip the Duke and Duchess of Sussex of their remaining royal patronages. Of course, the couple are due to be giving a key interview to Oprah Winfrey in the United States in the next 10 days. And the Duke and Duchess of Sussex have confirmed to Buckingham Palace that they're not going to be returning as working members of the royal family. So what do we make of all of this? Someone who knows her way around the monarchy and knows Prince Harry, of course, is Angela Levin, who is a royal biographer and author of Harry, Conversations with the Prince. This feels like, Angela, a final break, if that's the right expression. They've clearly passed or broken a red line in the Oprah interview.
Yes, absolutely. It reminded me of Prince Charles and Diana. When they split, the Queen was tolerant about that. And when they both went on television talking about their sex lives, she decided that was enough. And she wrote to them within a week and said, you have to divorce. This is an order. It's not a request. It's an order. And I think this is exactly the same thing. And she has thought that the interview with Oprah might damage the royal family very much, and so she must act, and act fast, because it was originally supposed to be decided by the end of March. But she could see that things are getting worse and worse. And what is particularly interesting is that we have the idea of her as the monarch and as the grandmother. She is very focused, as we know, on her sense of duty and her responsibility to the citizens. But she also loves her grandchildren, whatever they do, however they behave. And this one with the announcement was that they couldn't come back because if they were half in, half out, they've got to be totally responsible for their duty. And then at the end writes a very sad line, which says something like, we're all saddened by the decision. The Duke and Duchess remain much loved members of the family. And that's the grandmother bit. I felt very sorry when I read that, because I think her love of duty is so important, and it's very important to her that all her family feel the same way. It's been a passion since she ascended the throne in her early 20s, and she just wasn't going to have it ruffled up again. I think she'd be particularly worried about Meghan and what she might say, details about the royal family. There are no holds barred, we're told. Any question can be asked. And I think she still bears a grievance. It's absolutely astonishing, because without having married into the royal family, she wouldn't be rich. She wouldn't be asked everywhere. She wouldn't have the friends she has. She's a C-list actress, and now she's one of the most famous people in the world. But she still seems to me to carry a grudge.
And it's interesting, Angela, two things that struck me as well. This statement has been released by Her Majesty the Queen while Prince Philip is still in hospital. We know that Prince Philip, you know that very well, used to be or was very close to Harry. He'll be very sad to think now it's come to an end for Harry. But also I was struck by the statement the Sussexes put out, where they said very pointedly and very sharply about public service. In other words, it's not just you lot who can do public service. They said something like, it's universal.
Yes, you can do it anyway. You can serve anywhere. Now, they always seem to put these nasty little snide comments on. When the Queen, when they left last year in March, and the Queen said that they couldn't use the word royal, they couldn't have their Instagram account Royal Sussex, they put out a comment saying, you know, the Queen doesn't have any jurisdiction in the USA about whether we use royal or not,
yes,
or whether you
right.
can use royal or not. But nonetheless, we will agree not to use it. Patronising and spiteful.
The interview may, of course, be delayed if Prince Philip's health doesn't improve, and we all, of course, hope it does. What do you think, Angela, Prince Charles will be thinking now? This is his second son. It's all over. Is he ever going to come back to Britain? Will he ever see his grandfather? Will Charles see the second grandchild, who will be the first one to be born an American?
Well, that's what I think. I feel very sad for him. He's quite an emotional man. I was with him for a year to write a profile for his 70th birthday, and I was astonished how emotional he was. And I think he's loved his children in his own way, and he has tried very hard to bond with them. And I know for a fact that one very close to him told me that he's fond of Meghan. He thinks she's bring a fresh air, and that she comes from a dysfunctional family, and a lot of the royal family is dysfunctional.
Yes,
and
that's for sure.
So, and he also liked to have someone who was keen on the arts. And she was that too. And he did everything possible to make her feel welcome. Of course, walking her down the aisle, halfway down the aisle, was an example of that. And being very kind to her mother, who was there on her own without any other family apart from Meghan, and had Camilla on one arm, her mother on the other arm, as they walked out of the chapel. The woman didn't know what to do, poor Doria. It was overwhelming,
yes.
And understandably
yes.
so. So he's really bent over backwards. He's paid for them. He's given them lots of extra money to help them. And this is their thanks, I think, he'll think.
Absolutely. Where does this all end, Angela?
Well, I think it's incredibly, incredibly sad. And yes, I can't see Meghan wanting to come back at all, and Harry will be torn between a rock and a hard place. You know, loyalty to your wife, who he's crazy about still, fair enough, and loyalty to the family, who he feels a bit resentful towards. But in his heart, I guarantee he feels very sad. I mean, we heard today that he was put himself into isolation. So if, I hope not, he has to come over because of his great because of his grandfather, we won't have to stay. He could go and see and be part of the family straight away. Now, that's a man who really cares, but I think he's still very, very mixed up about everything.
I think that's right. That's Angela Levin, who is, of course, author of that book, Harry, Conversations with the Prince. Oh, Angela, to have a conversation with him right now.
I'd love to.
Of course, we all would. Angela Levin, always great to have you on board. People as young as 40 could now be offered the COVID vaccine within a matter of weeks. Government advisers are poised to recommend the next phase of the vaccine rollout continues on the basis of age rather than prioritising key workers. 40 to 49-year-olds will be invited once the 32 million in the top nine groups have had the jab. I'm joined now by Dr. Gabriel Scally, no stranger to this podcast, who is, of course, President of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Royal Society of Medicine, and he's a member of the Independent Sage Group. Dr. Scally, good to talk to you again. This is quite a significant break with what's happened before, because the age group here is 40 to 49. That's 10 years, effectively, whereas previously they've been dividing it into five-year groups.
Well, and it's an awful lot of people as well, 40 to 49, and it will be a real test, I think, of how much of the vaccine will be accepted by the general population, because you're now getting down into age groups where the incidence of death from COVID-19 is really much, much lower. So will people think it's worthwhile getting the vaccine? I think that's one of the really interesting questions that will start now to arise.
That would, of course, would be one of the arguments in favour of a COVID vaccine passport, because if people cannot get admitted, for instance, to a restaurant or on a plane, or to even perhaps do certain forms of work unless they've got a COVID vaccine passport, that might then encourage younger people who may be more reluctant to sign up to it, although to my mind that would drive a coach and horses through the idea of freedom and all the other issues that surround that.
Yes, it's going to be an interesting one. I think that there will be perhaps a role for a vaccine passport for international travel, for example, but I'm not sure it will really be used much domestically. I'd much rather we talk to people in terms of, well, it's not just all about dying, you know, it's about long COVID and bring that home to them. And the fact that people of all ages can get long COVID, and we now know that the rate of long COVID is really quite high. So people from 40 to 49 are far from immune from this, and maybe as many as 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 might get long COVID if they get the virus. So there's a lot to be said for everyone getting vaccinated if they possibly can.
And the issue of who should be prioritised has been a big issue for a long time. Key workers, the police or teachers, the Labour Party was certainly calling for teachers. But then, of course, other people were saying, what about people who work in a supermarket on a checkout or stack the shelves? Aren't they just as important? These things are fraught with difficulty. And of course, that's decisions mainly for the politicians. But if you were advising the politicians, Dr. Scally, what would you be telling them?
Well, I would encourage them to look very carefully at occupational groups and try and use the vaccine not just to protect the groups, but also to enable us to do things safely that we all have to do. And I do feel for people who work in the retail sector, in food shops, for example, and also, of course, for people like transport workers who sometimes see quite large numbers of people in the course of their daily lives. And we have got good data from the early part of the pandemic as to what occupational groups one really should be looking at. So I think there is a good point at looking towards occupational groups and making best use of the vaccine as we roll it out.
There's talk today, the Prime Minister, wherever he was doorstep today, said that the government intends that when they, as and when they know how much surplus vaccine they've got, we know they've ordered over 400 million, this is a country population of under 70 million, they will send them to poorer countries in what we used to call the third world. But is that position going to be a long way off still, Dr. Scally? Because, of course, when winter comes, the vaccine, the virus will be back with a vengeance.
Well, there will be a surplus of vaccine in due course. That's absolutely true. And the UK has a good record of donating large amounts of money to the World Health Organization and its COVAX program, which is designed to try and improve access to lesser developed countries. And we will have this surplus of ordered vaccine, and we should certainly help reduce the virus in developing countries, particularly those which are having a really, really high level of virus circulating at the moment. And it's absolutely in our interests to do that, because the more the virus replicates, the more mutants it will produce, the more of these variants, which could actually dodge the vaccine. So it's really very much and spread the vaccine around the world and use it to best effect.
If I could ask you as well, the vaccine rollout has still been so far has been this great success. What do you have advice still? Because we know there are still stubbornly parts of the country who are resisting the vaccine. That's particularly so in certain parts of the ethnic communities. And still, there are a number of care workers, Dr. Scally, who still haven't signed up to the jab, either because they don't want to or perhaps there's been problems with supply. What's your advice to those groups of people?
Oh, I would urge everyone who has the opportunity to have the vaccine, please do have it. It's not just to protect you, it's to protect your family and protect the people that you're working with as well as those you're looking after. So I think absolutely everyone should take it. I think we do need a lot of help and support from community leaders, particularly in BME communities, to get the message across and get people in. And I am worried about London and the fact that 1 in 5 people in the group have been vaccinated already, haven't, or offered the vaccine already, haven't taken up that offer. So 1 in 5 is a lot of people in those vulnerable age groups. And that, I'm not surprised at that, because London has a very poor record of vaccination in general in terms of childhood vaccination, and it's been a continuing problem for decades that has never really been tackled. And it's about the poverty of the of some of the people involved, but also the poverty of the public health system in London and the way in which it has never really tackled this very serious problem of under-vaccination, under-protection for the population of our biggest city.
That's Dr. Gabriel Scally, who is the President of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Royal Society of Medicine. Thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk, where you can listen to The Andrew Peer Show free of charge and in full, of course, along with all our other podcasts and our videos, plenty of them. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker, of course, to play Daily Mail News. Rules on care home visits could be relaxed within a matter of weeks. That's according to the Care Minister, Helen Wakeley. Six charities have banded together to urge the Prime Minister to allow visits to care homes by relatives from the beginning of March, saying visits are essential for the sake of humanity. I'm joined now by Nikki Gerard. You'll know her as the best-selling crime author, and she's co-founder of the dementia charity John's Campaign, who signed the open letter to the Prime Minister urging him to allow care home visits. Nikki, well done on the campaign. It seems it's paying dividends at last. There was a time when it seemed like Parliament might step in here. Harriet Harman, the former Labour deputy leader, says that the right to visit somebody in a care home is a human right. Do you agree with that?
I could not agree more. It is a human right. And for a year, that human right has been disregarded. And we hope that one of the things that will come out of this terrible year in care homes is something that is enshrined in law to say that this must never happen again and that everyone in a care home can have an essential carer visit them.
And one of the problems still will be, I guess, is that care home residents and staff in England in particular, they've been offered vaccinations against COVID, but some of them still haven't taken up that offer. Now, does that concern you, bearing in mind you're hoping that you can get into these care homes, visiting your loved one within a matter of weeks?
Well, it concerns me in the sense that I feel that in their own interests, in every way, they should have the vaccine, and all paid carers should have the vaccine, if you know, and that it protects them and protects everybody else. So, of course, it concerns me. But I have to say that our call for care homes to be open again to essential family carers is not wholly based on the fact that everyone will have had their vaccine. We think that regardless of whether everyone has had their vaccine, doors should now be open again. There is no reason to think that those family carers can't take exactly the same precautions and be given the same protection as paid carers. And I think all of them would queue up to do that. And then the doors can be opened so that they can be where they always should have been allowed to be, by the side of the person that they love. So, I mean, I think that there's very little evidence indeed to suggest that COVID has in any significant way been brought into care homes by family carers. That's not the path it's entered by. And yet family carers are the people who've been kept out of care homes. So we're saying that the vaccine makes a huge difference. People should have it. It should be one of the reasons why care homes should now feel able to allow essential visitors back in. But it's not the only reason. We know now enough about how to protect people from COVID. We know how to do it safely. We know that family, those essential carers, they will go an extra mile to do anything to make sure that they are safe. And after a year, it is unacceptable at every level to keep them out of the care home.
Tell us, Nikki Gerard, why for you this has been a very important and personal crusade.
So, I mean, as you probably know, John's campaign was launched over 6 years ago now after the death of my father. And he went into hospital, a hospital which was then completely closed to visitors because of an infectious outbreak of norovirus in this case. So, and during that time, he went off a cliff in well-being and he never recovered from it. So, and that was just for 5 weeks. For 5 weeks, he was pretty much abandoned by his family because we were so compliant to those rules. So 5 weeks destroyed my father, and that was why we launched the campaign in the first place. Now, this is a year during which tens of thousands of people who have dementia, who live in care homes, have been kept away from those who love them and who keep them linked to the world that they know and are, you know, that they're familiar with, their places of safety, their kind of their kind of psychological homes. And the damage of that has, I mean, it's untold suffering, and people have died. Literally, people have died of sadness in those care homes. So people with dementia have been locked into homes. Those that love them have been locked out of homes. And it's just, it feels like a disgrace on a mass scale that we need to just now stand up and say, no, that is enough. A year of this, that is enough. There is nothing. There is nothing that can be said to be put in the way of letting people back into care homes. There is no reason for care homes not to open their doors.
Because the great tragedy for people like your father, who was denied access to his family, who loved him for 5 weeks, people who've not been able to see their loved ones who've got dementia for a year, you can't explain, as I know from my own father who had dementia, you can't explain why they're not, the people they love aren't coming to see them, because they don't get it. And that must have made some of these people's last months so unbearable.
So unbearable. Unbearable for them and unbearable for people who love them, who wanted to go into the home and be there and have not been allowed to. I mean, I think a lot of people feel that they're no longer loved by their family, or they've somehow are being punished by them for reasons that they don't understand. We have heard countless stories of people who have died on their own, thinking that their family have just let go of them. Or stories where people have died and people are finally allowed in at the end of their life, but their loved one is unconscious by then, so they will never have known. And, you know, think of what it's like for the person in the home, but also think of what it's like for the relatives. Think of living for the rest of your life with the knowledge that you weren't there. At the time when you were most needed, you weren't there. And even though it wasn't their fault because they weren't allowed to be there, that guilt, that unresolved guilt, that kind of trauma of distress, that's not going to be resolved for decades. That the inheritance of that is going to last for always.
That's Nikki Gerard, the best-selling author, who is, of course, the co-founder of the charity John's Campaign. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, please subscribe to us. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And if you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. So summer holidays to Greece, they could be back on the agenda, but only if you've been vaccinated. The Greek tourism minister, Harry Theoharis, says technical discussions have already started with UK officials after dropping restrictions for holidaymakers who have vaccination certificates. I'm joined now by the Daily Mail's wonderful travel editor, Mark Palmer. Mark, 4 million Britons normally visit Greece every year. Do you think quite a few of us, if we've got that vaccine certificate, will be able to go this summer after all?
I do, Andrew, and I think every week when we talk, there's a different scenario. Some weeks we're a little bit down in the dumps, and other weeks we're feeling a bit more chipper. And thankfully, we have good reason to feel chipper today. I think we should remember that if you project the rate of infection across other parts of Europe, and Greece in particular, but also Portugal and Spain, I have it on very good authority from people who have been really studying the data very carefully, and they're saying that by the end of March that we will be in the same position infection rate wise in those countries as we were last July. And last July, we were able, with those travel corridors, to travel quite freely. And the situation has moved on now that people are being vaccinated and they will have their certificate or will have something to show that they've had the jab. And I'm far more optimistic and think that we could well be traveling actually internationally, I would say, by the beginning of May.
That's fantastic. Now, Mark, one thing, if we were to go to Greece for a holiday, I've always loved the Greek islands. If I went for 2 weeks, 10 days, does it mean when I get back, I have to isolate at home for 10 days, a week, 5 days? What is the drawback?
Well, you wouldn't have to, as it stands at the moment, unless suddenly Greece had a huge rise in infections and went on the dreaded sort of red list of countries. No, you absolutely wouldn't. In fact, I would have thought that by May, those quarantine hotels will be something of the past. And I think you'll be able to come back quite freely and won't have to even go into quarantine at home at all.
And currently, Greece requires proof of a negative COVID test taken 72 hours before boarding a flight there. And then would we have to take two more or take more tests when we get there?
I'm imagining that as it stands at the moment, certainly the Britain would require you to have a test 72 hours before coming back. And as it stands at the moment, then to have another test within sort of 3 days of your arrival back. But that is the situation now where nobody's travelling anyway. And I don't think that will be the situation come the 1st of May, and certainly not in July. I mean, a lot of people are talking about July and August being very much back on. And I think they will, not just in Greece, but in other countries, which one shouldn't forget, Andrew, that countries like Spain are just longing to have the British there and longing for us to come and spend some money.
And we're longing for some sun.
Well, that's it. And the other reason that that I think, even though we've read a lot about how infection rates have been high in France and Spain and elsewhere on the continent, but let's also remember the weather is changing. And we know that the scientists tell us that this virus thrives in cold conditions and doesn't like warm weather. So in Spain, for example, the weather in the south of Spain is really getting quite mild now, and that also has to be a good sign. So there's a lot of positives coming out of this, and I just hope that on Monday that Boris will go a bit further than what we think he's going to say, and will also give us some sort of roadmap to our summer holidays.
Have you packed your suitcase yet?
My suitcase is permanently packed, Andrew, as you know. I keep cancelling flights and thinking, oh, well, it'll be another couple of months, and then cancelling it again. I'm absolutely ready to go. I'm dusting down the amber solaire and can't wait.
Well, if you need someone to come along and polish your shoes, Mark Palmer, I'll be your slave boy. How's that?
Excellent, Andrew.
Sounds a deal. That's Mark Palmer, the Daily Mail's estimable travel editor. Thanks for joining us. That time of the podcast now, Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicholls is here to guide me through the minefield that is the football season this weekend, because it's getting interesting. What are the big matches, Tim?
Well, there's a lot of big matches this weekend, Andrew. None more so than the Merseyside derby. It's Liverpool versus Everton at Anfield. Of course, no fans, which would certainly make a bit of a difference in the cauldron of Anfield. But it's a huge game for a number of reasons. I mean, Everton haven't won at their big rival since 1999 in the league. It's a long, long time to wait. And some of the talk in the build-up to the game is that they'll never have a better opportunity. Liverpool have lost their last three Premier League games in a row. They've also lost three in a row at home, which has been unheard of after they had that fantastic two-year unbeaten run at home. But they did play, Liverpool played in the Champions League midweek, looked a lot better against Leipzig and won that game. But it's a really important game for Everton. They are chasing Liverpool. They'll move level on points with their big rivals with a game in hand if they can win it. But they've been a bit inconsistent themselves. They've only won one of the last six games. They do welcome back their main man up front, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who has got a real chance of going to the European Championships this summer with England. But it's going to be a fascinating game. You know, both teams really need to win. And there is also the sort of subtext of this game is that earlier in the season at Goodison Park, when these two teams met, the Everton goalkeeper Jordan Pickford committed a pretty shocking challenge on Virgil van Dijk, the £75 million Liverpool defender, who's been such a colossus for them since signing from Southampton. Really has been the key to them winning the title, winning the Champions League. He's just been an absolutely brilliant player for them. He's not played since. It was a terrible challenge. Van Dijk is still recovering from the injury. And I think there is a little bit of bad blood between these two at the moment. And I think Liverpool will certainly be out for a bit of revenge. I'm sure, they'll try and play it all down in the build-up. But the fact is that they were very unhappy about that and will want to come out on top in the derby. It's going to be a fascinating evening game tomorrow.
And what about the top of the title? Because talking to you earlier this week, Tim. It seems pretty much Liverpool are out of the race now for the title. They're just trying to get a place in the top four.
They are. I think Jurgen Klopp, their manager, has accepted that. They're too far behind Manchester City, who have been absolutely sensational in recent weeks and months. I mean, they've got on paper is a tricky game at Arsenal on Sunday afternoon, but Man City have won 17 games in a row. They're 10 points clear at the top. They're in the League Cup final. They're in the FA Cup quarterfinals. They're in the Champions League next week. They've done a lot of this without two key players in Aguero and De Bruyne. Not lost a game at all since November. And they've won the last eight meetings between these two in the Premier League. So you've got to fancy City to probably extend their lead at the top this weekend. They are playing so well. They've got some fantastic players. And, it's going to be very... I mean, Liverpool, as I said, they are out of it. Manchester United and Leicester are the only two teams who could really have any, realistic hopes of catching them. But they're 10 points behind. It's an awful lot to make up, when we've only got 14 games to go. I think City, unless there's some kind of huge implosion there, they're going to win the league. They're going to win it comfortably, probably by more than the 10 points clear that they are at the moment. But it's not an easy game for them at Arsenal. I have to say that, Mikel Arteta, despite their position in the league, is doing quite a good job there. And Arteta was previously part of Pep Guardiola's backroom team at Manchester City. They got some very good youngsters in Emil Smith Rowe and Bukayo Saka, both of which have really impressed this season. So it won't be an easy game for Man City, but they're just relentless at the moment. They really will take some stopping. So it's going to be interesting to see how they get on in that game. But like I say, it's only really Leicester and Man United, I think, that can catch them now. Liverpool really playing to get into the top four, which is so key. So many teams are competing for that. Chelsea, West Ham, Everton as well, possibly even Spurs and Arsenal. So it's, there's so much still to play for in the Premier League, despite the fact that, the bottom three look like they're cut adrift and Man City is so far clear at the top. There is one other game I'd like to talk to you about before I go.
Yeah, do. Sure.
A local derby, West Ham Spurs at the Olympic Stadium on Sunday lunchtime. It's a really, really important game for both teams. I'll start with Spurs. Jose Mourinho is under huge pressure at Tottenham. They've lost five of their last six league games. 12 points from 12 games since they went top of the league in November. They've really, really fallen on hard times. And if they were to lose this game at West Ham, I think that the pressure would be intolerable on him and he would be under serious pressure, which, it's not often he leaves a club without winning anything, but he's not really had the impact that Tottenham would have hoped for. And if they were to lose this game, they'd be 9 points behind West Ham, which, if you look at the two squads on paper, you'd say that Spurs is stronger. But David Moyes has done a fantastic job at West Ham this season. They are on a brilliant run of form. They've won 12 games this season. This is the game they love to win more than any other. And they know that they can essentially end Tottenham's hopes of a top four place if they were to win this game and also strengthen theirs. They are right in the mix with Chelsea and Liverpool and Everton. I mean, they're 4 points behind Manchester United, who are second. This is sort of uncharted territory for West Ham, but they fully deserve to be where they are because they've been playing really, really well and totally unexpected after they narrowly avoided relegation last season. So it's going to be a fascinating battle, that one on Sunday. Harry Kane's going to come back in for Spurs. There's a chance that Gareth Bale will play as well. But I'm sorry to keep banging on about it, but it is such a shame there are no fans there because I tell you what, 60,000 West Ham fans would be absolutely loving that one on Sunday. But they're just three games this weekend. It's going to be another fantastic weekend of Premier League football. It just keeps on coming, Andrew. It's a season like no other, and it's relentless.
Fascinating stuff. That's the Deputy Sports Editor, Tim Nicholls. Thanks for joining us. So March, we know, is a traditional time to have a spring clean, even if you're not great on housework like me. But should you also have a digital one this year instead, bearing in mind many of us have been working from home on our computer throughout the day? And if you have got virtual clutter, how do you get rid of it? Think about it. Photographs, unwanted subscriptions, emails that have been languishing in the inbox for potentially years. Well, I'm joined now by Dawn George. She's a certified professional organizer, productivity consultant, and she is Evernote certified consultant. Dawn, so I must have 3,000 emails in my inbox, most of which I've read, some I haven't read, some I know I'm never going to read. How do I start?
Well, you are not alone. This is a very common issue that many people face. One of the first things I would suggest to start organizing your emails is you can, depending upon the type of mail service you use, you can create folders, and you can, what I like to do is put things into folders based upon the next action that I need to take. So if there's some newsletters and things that I want to read, I'll create a folder that just says to read, and I'll drag anything in there that I want to read. If it's something that you don't need anymore, or specifically if there are newsletters and things that you really don't want anymore, I would suggest doing a search in your email for the word unsubscribe. And usually that will bring up any newsletters or other things that you're just subscribed to, and go through and actually take the time to unsubscribe. A lot of people will just say, oh, I'll just delete it, but it still comes in. It's kind of like getting mail in your post office box, and it does take the time. You have to throw it away. So just don't let it come in. So definitely unsubscribe, create folders based on the next action, and don't be afraid to delete things. If someone just says thanks, you know, for an email that you sent, you don't need to keep that. Definitely delete.
Do you think people are paranoid about deleting things, though, Dawn, in case we've deleted something by mistake that we really did need to keep? Is that the problem, if your finger's hovering over the delete button?
Good question, Andrew. Yeah, I do think that sometimes we can be afraid. Now, of course, those simple emails that are like, thanks, and they don't have any information in it, don't be afraid to email, delete those. But one other thing that I encourage my clients to do is you can also create an archive folder. And whenever I've kind of processed a piece of mail, I've read it, it makes sense to me, I don't need to take any action on it and put it in a folder, I will actually just drag it over and put it into the archive folder so that I can later on, if I really needed to, search and say, oh, you know what, Andrew sent me something. Let me search his name and remember what was that last conversation we had, just to refresh your memory. So that can be a nice step for people if they feel, instead of wanting to delete something entirely, just dragging it out of the inbox. Because I think, like you said, you know, we have thousands and thousands of emails clogging our inbox, and that's not productive, because a lot of people use their inbox as if it's a to-do list. And when you have thousands of emails in your inbox, it's not productive. You're overwhelmed, and you need to get rid of the junk and get rid of the things you've actually processed, and then focus on what is the next action I need to take and do that. But you can't do that when there's thousands in your inbox.
And you also recommend using a tool called Duplicate Files Fixer. Now, what is that? It sounds straightforward, but what does it mean?
It is. So oftentimes, especially in our downloads folder, we have duplicate files. We may have downloaded something to our downloads folder, or we've saved it in multiple places on our computer. And what the Duplicate Files Fixer finds is just that. It may find duplicate photos that are exactly the same, audio files, documents, things that are duplicates and just taking up space. I mean, if you had a file drawer of papers and you had multiple duplicates in it, that's kind of pointless. So that particular application, and you can Google it, Duplicate Files Fixer, it can find those duplicates and delete it. And it always makes sure to that it's an exact duplicate. If there was an edit or something, and even if it had the same name, it will not delete a document or a photo or an audio file if it's not an exact duplicate. So you can be pretty certain to use that and feel comfortable.
And if you do clear out your computer and have a declutter, does the computer function more swiftly, or does it enable you to find things more easily, or is it a bit of both?
It is certainly a bit of both. Certainly getting rid of excess files, excess applications, things like that will definitely make your computer run a lot more quickly. And it's just like anything. I mean, even in your home, if you've got a lot of extra clutter, it takes more time to find what you need. So being sure to clear out your virtual space, just like you would clear out your home and maybe your desktop, your physical desktop at home, it's just as important to do it with your virtual space, especially considering the fact that we're all probably at home and using our devices a lot more often because of the pandemic.
And finally, and I really like this idea, because I certainly should do it, because I'm a bit of a fiend on Twitter, you recommend unfollowing some accounts, and particularly unfollowing ones that are negative.
Yeah, and I think in this day and age, you know, we all spend a lot of time on social media, and perhaps more often than we should, and it really can cut into our productivity. Now, of course, there's benefits to being on social media, being in the know about what's happening, connecting with friends and family, you know, internationally and just close to home. But it's important to not get caught up in everything that's going on. And I really encourage people to kind of look at who are you following on social media. And if you're constantly scrolling over posts that are either negative or just, more importantly, just things that you're not interested in, again, that's kind of like that clutter that's you know, mucking up the system. So go ahead and unfollow people that you don't like to follow. And I think you'll kind of see that you're spending less time on social media because of it.
Very good. That's Dawn George, who is a certified consultant with Evernote. Thanks for that great advice. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a really great weekend and good night.